Welcome to this Bob Thurman podcast. This is Bob Thurman, and happy Tibetan New Year of the Firebird, Tibetan Royal Year 2144. I'm very happy to be able to share these teachings, old and new, that I've done over the years by the kindness of some very dear friends who have informally volunteered and helped me do them. We have apparently reached 108, and I'm still alive, and I will carry on, I suppose, at different frequencies. And if you enjoy them, you might think of two things. One, become a member of Tibet House US, which you can find online, and join up as a member of some sort, appropriate to who or what you are. And we really need members to show the world that people care about preserving Tibetan culture. Tibet House US is the American Cultural Center of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We're officially allowed to say that. It is the fact. He's the patron and the co-founder of it. And we also have a wonderful facility in upstate New York, only 2.2 hours north of New York, called Menla Mountain Retreat and Spa Resort. And the reason we have that is that we are introducing the knowledge of Tibetan spiritual healing, Tibetan spiritual medicine in the West, in America. And so if you become members, come visit Menla, come to Tibet House US. We have art collections and things. Although we're very low-key, we're very humble, we need a lot of support. That would be really great, but you don't have to do anything. Just enjoy your lives, learn something from the podcast. That's really the reward for me, is if you learn something, and if it in any tiny way, in any what Bill Murray called baby step way, if it improves your life to the tiniest degree, I will really be happy. So have a great year. This is the year of the phoenix, the firebird, rising from some ashes that were created by all kind of crazy behavior on the planet of the fire monkey that we just left, thank heavens. So I hope you all have a great year and a great life, and I hope to see some of you here and there as I do now and then, and it's always a pleasure. Okay.
This is episode 108, Force for Good, Buddhist Inner Sciences.
All right. So, Buddhist science and the force for good. As I told somebody earlier today, I'm being a little naughty in my doing the Buddhist sources of the force for good. Dan Goleman informed me when I came up with the idea of doing it last spring that the force for good was secular. It wasn't about Buddhism. It was about using the Buddhist things in a secular way. So, but which I think is good. And actually, my idea about Buddhist science is that Buddha himself was being secular in his own time, I think. I consider that he was. So I consider His Holiness the Dalai Lama to be following the footsteps of Buddha himself, Shakyamuni Buddha. Why do I say that Shakyamuni Buddha was secular? People just assume, I think, that, for example, the theory of karma was already existing in Vedic India, where Buddha lived in the 6th, 5th century before the Common Era. They just assumed that, wrongly. And they assumed that he wanted to fit into the world religion competition and found a religion. But that was really not the case. He was a prince. He was supposed to be a king. His father went to tremendous lengths to get him to be a king and was really upset when he left home. at the age of 29, instead of at the time when he just should have. Well, there are different versions of the story, actually, about the birth of his son. There are two different versions. One of them is very exceptionally cruel to his wife, that she carried the baby for 6 years in her womb. There is a version like that. And I think that's really ridiculous and cruel. And the other one is that she just had given birth to the baby, and it was right after that the Buddha left. Because when the tradition was that when the crown prince gives birth to a son, the father king in normal times withdraws from the throne, abdicates, and the son takes over. And so then the father was putting the heat on Buddha once the son was born to assume the throne. And Buddha refused. The only way he could refuse was he refused, saying that, "Well, I would be king, Dad, if as a king I could do something about the problems of my citizens, because haven't you always taught me that the king should help achieve the welfare of his subjects?" And the king said, "Yes, actually, I'm going to put my shoes on because my feet are cold, and that's going to make me more sniffly. The air conditioning is just too much. I wonder if we could open the window to get the ordinary climate temperature. I was just fine a minute ago." And he said, "I would do that, but..." And the dad said, "Well, yes, son, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to defend them against enemies. You work on the education and welfare, this kind of thing." And the Buddha said, "Yes, Dad, but the problems of my subjects are not worrying about enemies as much as they are sickness, old age, even birth, and death. Those are their real problems, and I don't see how I'm going to be able to help them at all by being a king." And the father said, "Well, but you know, kings are not supposed to do that. You leave that to the priests. And the priests leave it to the gods, you know. The priests intercede with the gods, to the gods, you know, for people to take care of those problems. So you just, you know, support the priests and they'll take care of that kind of thing and you don't worry about it." And then Buddha said, "Well, if the priests are supposed to take care of dealing with the problems of sickness, old age, and death, they're doing a lousy job. And I think I can do better. And so I'm going to go off and I'm going to seek the meaning of life, the nature of reality, and I'm going to find some way to try to help my people, free them from their suffering." So Dad said, "Is that so?" And he then proceeded to lock him up and send in the shrinks, who were in those days the Brahmin priests, you know, who were very learned and wonderful. They knew the Vedas, they performed rituals, they were very wise in ways, and they were the religious people. So I'm saying Buddha rebelled against the religion of his time, is what I'm saying. And he wasn't trying to found a counter-religion. He very carefully, when he set up, once he attained enlightenment, at first he was trying to sort of following what the few Brahmins who sought to realize the nature of reality, not just do rituals, you know, great yogis, and he tried to do that. And he succeeded very well in that, but he found that did not give him the answer, actually. Doing yoga and meditating by itself did not give him the answer. And he was investigating the inner and outer reality instead. And then when he became enlightened, when he discovered the nature of reality, and then he taught and he founded a community, the way he founded the community was he would meet people, and he would sort of, when they would be in his field, they would sort of become more self-aware, you could say, "Hey, how are you?" They would become more self-aware, and he would say to them, "Well, do you want to do what you've been doing, or do you want to know what the nature of reality, do you want to be free of suffering," sort of thing. He would kind of offer that to them, and then they would say, normally if someone offered you that, you would think, "Well, you can't deliver that, so why should I even think about it?" But apparently Buddha's field was such that they would take it seriously. And then they would say, "Yeah, maybe, sure." And then they would enter his community. He would say, "Ehi bhikkhu, come here mendicant, meaning if you have to really give yourself to do this, to follow this path. And then he would teach them. And then mendicant, he didn't say come here monk or come here nun. He said come here mendicant. And mostly to men at first, and later to women for their own community. But with some reluctance he had about that, because he knew that the ordinary society would not welcome the liberation of their female slaves, virtual slaves, to go and seek the nature of reality and drop out of the household and drop out of the childbearing and drop out of the cooking and drop out of all the work that they did. So he was a little reluctant. And also he knew that females were more advanced than males, actually, and didn't need to drop out as much as the males did. And he really knew about that with relation to the males, because he had been raised to be a general. He was a West Pointer. He wasn't some liberal arts like sort of woo-woo person at all. He was a military person. So he knew about men, you know, that they're violent, you know, and that therefore they are unrealistic. And they need some special discipline to be able to change themselves. You know, they need a special setting. They need a kind of really rigorous university training. And people say monastic, and it's all right to say that, but it was different than a monastic thing, in that they didn't go there to worship God. They went there out of dissatisfaction with God, actually. Like the Dalai Lama is dissatisfied with religions when he does the force for good thing, and he wants to have a secular ethic, and he wants to talk to scientists. He also wants religions not to fight with each other, so that's one of his major things in life. And he is a Buddhist monk, and he accepts that as what people think of as a Buddhist monk. He's thought of as a religious leader, so he accepts that responsibility. But his first thing is promoting human values. Of his three aims in life, his first aim is to promote common human values. As you all know, I'm sure you all know the Dalai Lama. About the Dalai Lama, you wouldn't be here. And that means, you know, his religion is kindness, not any particular world religion, you know. And he doesn't, that's why he also makes a big fuss. He doesn't want to convert anybody to Buddhism. He doesn't want anybody who is not a Buddhist to be a Buddhist, because he doesn't want the other people to try to convert the Buddhists or each other and then come into competition for market share and create interreligious violence, which he was talking about and saying that since the 80s, since the 70s, since I first met him, actually, in the 60s. And he was on my case because I was, I won't say anti-Christian, but I was a little anti-religious. And I still am, actually, somewhat. I was once taken to a think tank situation where I was categorized as a religious leader, and I kept complaining. I said, I'm not a religious leader, I'm a professor. Oh no, you're a religious leader because you're a Buddhist, they were telling me. So we got there, and this was a setting where think tank where people were talking about how government has broken down, corporations have broken down, institutions have broken down, and then there was a panel of quote unquote religious leaders. So then different religious leaders gave their talk about what their religion was doing and how great it was. And then I said, I'm sorry to be the naysayer here a little bit, I said, but I told you I wasn't a religious leader when you invited me. But, you know, I do know something about Buddhism, but I'm not a leader. And I said, religions have also broken down. There's another bunch of broken down institutions. And why are they broken down? Because they've forgotten that religions are service institutions. They're service industries. They're there to serve people if they can be helped, you know, to have a better life. They're not corporate owner institutions. Their followers are not their, you know, are not their property, you know. They're not their, they don't own their followers, in other words, you know. Like the chief rabbi or the pope or the high top minister or the head of the Archbishop of Canterbury or the mullah of this and that or whatever, they don't own their followers. When they think they do, then they are betraying the principles of their founders. I gave a talk like that. I was very much congratulated after the talk by General Petraeus, who happened to be present. And I wasn't congratulating him necessarily, actually. I was surprised. I'm sorry I keep snuffling, but you just have to bear with it. Okay, so in other words, so the Buddha, therefore the Buddha founded his movement, or his movement naturally evolved. He didn't really found anything. It naturally evolved from the fact that he discovered what was reality. And that is the goal of science, I believe, is to know, distinguish between what's real and what's unreal, and really discover what's real reality, right? Which is why they're very frustrated nowadays. Since 1926, they've been frustrated, because they were very determined for over a century, or more even, that reality was material, and they lost track of matter. The quantum people couldn't find matter, so it dissolved under analysis, and they issued the Copenhagen Declaration, where you can't find the depth of reality, you cannot grasp it with a concept, you can't even see it as an absolute objectivity, because at the micro level, when you analytically have taken things apart and apart and apart and apart, whatever you observe at that level, your act of observation interferes with it, so your mind is part of it, what you're observing. So therefore, there's nothing absolutely objective. So therefore, you can't control reality with a theory. They discovered that. And then I was so pleased a few years ago, not that long ago, I met a man named Henry Stapp, famous quantum physicist, senior, who said after that declaration, even the quantum people split into two groups. And one of the groups, and I never thought of Einstein as a quantum physicist, but you know he was trying to get involved in quantum. And he said Einstein led the rebellion against the Copenhagen Declaration with his famous statement, God does not play dice, and his idea that he was going to come up with a grand unified theory, and that theory would capture the nature of reality. And many quantum theorists followed that. He gave this, you know, as a quantum physicist, he gave that analysis. And therefore, they got into all these kind of really crazy things like 11 dimensions and string theory and things that they're beautiful mathematically and they're marvelous. They're like symphonic even. But they are hampered that there are no experiments to confirm or deny them. Therefore, in a way, you find those kind of quantum philosophers shifted on campuses into philosophy departments. We have some at Columbia who are actually quantum philosophers. And he said, and Henry said that the actual quantum researchers who came up with things that, you know, quantum computers, you know, quantum this and that, lasers, whatever, tracking black hole experiments, you know, whatever you can call them, all the different things they did, they ignored all those theories. They followed the Copenhagen thing and they said, we're not trying to find the final theory that captures reality. We're working with what happens and empirically. And in doing so, they discovered and they did. That's where the advances in quantum have actually come, according to Henry Stapp, anyway, which I really was so pleased to hear that because that fit, I believe intuitively that's so, although I can't, you know, I can't prove it as if I'm not a quantum physicist. But in that case, Bohr and Heisenberg and those who agreed with him in 1926 in Copenhagen were correct, then that means they verified a prediction, a scientific prediction made by Buddha, known as the theory of selflessness or emptiness. So that's a physical theory, actually. It's a theory that, because Buddha was investigating atoms, and there were physicists in India who had ideas like the Greeks at that time of an indivisible atom as the building block of nature, of material nature, physical nature. They had such an idea. They definitely had the idea of themselves as having sort of moments of consciousness as irreducible selves, as that's me, I'm really here, you know, and I'm something irreducible. And he dissolved not only that internal sense of my point of subjectivity is an irreducible sort of atomic, momentic, if you will, entity in time and space, and also atoms are not, they're no indivisible atoms, they dissolve under analysis, And what you find when you seek reality is emptiness. And even the word emptiness is not quite right, because that emptiness is also empty. So, and it's not nothingness. That emptiness being empty, it is the condition that allows things to be relative, fully relative. So it is actually the discovery of relativity. They can go on and on about dependent co-origination, interdependent disintermediation, and that pratityasamutpada, but actually the great Buddhist thinker, philosopher, scientist, call it relativity. That's what they mean by pratityasamutpada. And they, and it's, in one way it's pratityanutpada, the interdependent non-production. You know, because they make a big fuss about actually nothing is produced. If you really look for your own causation, you won't find anything. You'll disappear under analysis. Your sources will disappear under analysis, mental and physical. And but that will not destroy you as a relative being. That will liberate you as a relative being to be really responsibly relative. Although there'll be some experience as if you were disappearing in the process of understanding that. And we'll talk more about that later. So therefore, that's why I say Shakyamuni Buddha was being secular in the sense of not following the religious doctrines of his time and not actually propounding himself a religious doctrine about ultimate reality, saying that that ultimate, what he found to be ultimate reality in a way can only be addressed by a pure negation. And the word emptiness is a negation. It is not an affirmation. And the word selflessness is a negation. And actually the word freedom is a negation, which could be a synonym of it. Freedom, you know, we think of, in America, we think of freedom as like, I don't know, like an empty football field, free, you know, open to be run upon and to fight the other side or something. Or we think of freedom as the aftermath of a battle. Or something that people in Texas are really into. But actually we also use the word free, salt-free, sugar-free, trouble-free. We use it as a negation. So free means lack of negation of bondage or binding. Free means, right? So that in a way, so, and a negation doesn't capture what it negates. If you say, there's no elephant in the room here, you know, real flesh and blood elephant. There might be an elephant on someone's charm bracelet, but there's no flesh and blood elephant in the room. You never really perceive a non-elephant. You don't capture, the negation of non-elephant doesn't capture anything. It just looks through the room and doesn't find what it was looking for. So it doesn't enclose around anything, something like that. You could keep on looking for the elephant, endlessly looking for a micro-elephant or something. You know, there's no limb, there's no end to it, in other words. So it is the same as the negation of the Copenhagen Declaration that the deep nature of reality is unsusceptible to expression, unsusceptible to formulation, unsusceptible to theorizing, and captured by conceptualization, which is what it was. And Buddha did actually experimentally, experiential means experimental. So he experimentally verified that in his own experience in a non-capturing way. He opened his heart and mind and being and time and space and became present in all of time and space, actually, which resulted in an experience of being present in all of time and space, which, if you think about what that means when you say that, you realize that that's kind of paradoxical and impossible. So it's just, all you can say is he didn't grasp any particular thing. Right? You can say. Just like, you know, you can talk about eating an apple, but the phrase eating an apple, I'm eating an apple, but what you do when you eat an apple is not expressed by saying I'm eating an apple. That's just one parameter of it, let's say, of what actually happens, right? All kinds of things happen. I have a cold. That doesn't express it. Trust me. So, and then based on that, he decided he would describe the relative, but he, with a caveat, which is just again preceding by 2,500 years, Karl Popper's famous theory of science, that laws of nature, scientific theories, are hypotheses awaiting further verification. They are hypotheses that account for experience, experiments, data, in the best possible way, most elegant, most accurate possible way, but awaiting falsification by the continuing accumulation of more experience and more data. So they're not rigid dogmas. They can't be, to be truly scientific. And also, a theory that cannot be experimented, cannot be, you know, tested, is not a valid, is not a useful scientific theory. It's a dogma. Popper made such a theory. But of course, we take the law of gravity, you know, people in popular sense do take these laws of nature as if they were absolute. And particularly modern science is not just Western, but modern, globally modern science is very hampered by having adopted the dogma of matter and materialism and reductionism about the mind, so that they're operating in a psychotic manner as if they didn't have minds and that they weren't subjectively present, you know, which is crippling to their success, actually, in the long run, although they still have spectacular material effect. Hi. Hello. Are you? Yeah, oh, you're okay. There are some chairs here, but better to stay further away from you because I have a cold. So, therefore, he made a caveat that all descriptions, although of relative reality, are just that, relative. They're contextual. They're not absolute. So therefore, the theory of karma, which just means causality, causation, is a description of causation at some level that is can be useful, and it accounts for some data that he experimentally encountered by remembering his many previous lives and becoming aware of other people's past evolutionary histories. And so it's a theory of evolution, not a dogmatic one. It could be, it has been found useful by hundreds of millions of people for thousands of years, but it's not still not absolute. As the Dalai Lama told Carl Sagan once, who asked him, which we have on video, actually I don't have, but somebody does, on video, they said, Your Holiness, what would be to Carl Sagan, right? What would you do if we set up a foolproof experiment and prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was no such thing as reincarnation? Weighty. And His Holiness thinks for a minute, he says, well, I would stop believing in it. Said, I would reject the hypothesis. I would reject that theory. He said, we have to give up our theories if they are, no matter how sacrosanct they may seem, if they contradict evidence and if they are not factual. And Sagan was completely at a loss. He couldn't believe that this reincarnate, famous reincarnate Lama said he would stop believing in incarnation should it be so proved. And while he was reeling from this extraordinary event, the Dalai Lama brightly asks him, now how are we going to go about setting up that experiment? Let's get on it. And he did not have anything to say. So karma, now at the time, the word karma didn't mean simply causality. The word karma meant an act performed in a sacred ritual. Like, you know, you would offer such and such a thing to the god Mitra to see to it that you settled a lawsuit properly, to the god Indra to see that you had victory in battle, to Dyaus, the god of the sky, or Prithvi, the mother earth, who was only one of only two female Vedic gods. You would offer to have, you know, progeny, fertility, you know. And I forget who was the Vedic wealth deity, maybe Agni himself, fire, you know. And so acts that you did toward those gods would then give you a positive effect in your life according to the religion. So that's what karma meant. It was a mystic theory, a religious theory. And Buddha rejected that. He said, it's not the gods. You have fortune or misfortune. You live or die. You win or lose, depending on what you did in previous time. There's a causality, an ethical causality. He made an ethical theory, actually, a biological / ethical theory out of the causality of actions, and not only physical actions, verbal actions and mental actions. And that last was the kicker, because those actions were the most powerful. Because, of course, they motivated good or bad verbal and physical actions, either greed or generosity, either hatred or love, either insight and wisdom, or delusion and fanaticism and false convictions. Either pride or humility, etc. You can go through all the duplicate good and bad virtues. So he saw, experientially on the surface, just like the quantum people, looking at the probabilities on the surface in a flexible, improvable, perhaps, theory of how people got to be how they got to be. And then, marvelously, human beings got to be human by being ethical in previous lives as lesser animals. They were more, and even as gods, they were more ethical, meaning, because there are some gods who are very self-centered and therefore not ethical. They have great pleasures, but they don't care for their partners in the pleasure. And the human mammal is one who has a natural sense of empathy, although the female does more than the male, which is why he was focused on the males at first, actually. Rather than being a chauvinist himself, he realized the males were in worse trouble and definitely knew that they caused more trouble, which they still do, in fact. I think. Sorry, Paul. If enlightenment is a kind of expanded empathy, such that a person like the Dalai Lama meets someone and sort of feels how they feel, and therefore the way they interact with that person has a good chance of being helpful to that person, because, or groups of people, because such a being feels how they feel, which is why in Buddhist tradition, to be a spiritual guru, actually, to really be a spiritual teacher, you have to have some degree of clairvoyance. Someone who's not clairvoyant can be an academic type teacher, they can be an informational type teacher, they can be a skill imparting teacher, but they shouldn't try to take on sort of the role of really what is best for someone spiritually. Although, of course, they do so. But they shouldn't, actually, according to the Buddhist tradition, because a true spiritual teacher should really be able to a little bit read the mind of their student to make sure that what they're telling them is helpful to them and not harmful to them. Because Buddha never gave dogmatic teachings in the sense of sort of realistic, intrinsically dogmatic, really dogmatic. In other words, he gave teachings that are really useful, but not dogmatic. And even the theory about ultimate reality, the only dogma maybe is that there's no dogma, let's say, I put it that way. Maybe that's a dogma, but that's a negation. So it's not really, it's a katma, not a dogma. So therefore he was being secular. He secularized the notion that was alive in his society of action being powerful as affecting your destiny. He secularized it, and he put the responsibility on the individual that you make your destiny by what you do in interaction with the nature, with other beings, and also in your thought interaction, not just in your physical and verbal one. And this is why there was so much emphasis in Buddhism on becoming self-aware. Because, you could be being nice and then thinking how I wish so-and-so were dead. And that mental killing in the mind is a very bad karma, although you didn't do it, so that's better. But the mind doing it gives you the effect still of separating yourself from that person's life and therefore cutting off your sense of identification with that person and therefore being destructive to yourself and making yourself less of a person And not to mention that how you will interact with that person, even though you're purportedly doing something positive with them, you really wish they were gone. And so inevitably what you do will be not helpful to them, actually. In fact. So therefore, the force for good of Shakyamuni Buddha was secular in its time. And the karma theory was his proto-Darwinian or pre-Darwinian evolutionary theory, which has all the elements of Darwin that people object to today, the fundamentalists object to today, all those elements about the human interwovenness with other animals and males' interwovenness with females and people of different races and nations being interwoven because everybody's been reborn as every other kind of being, actually. So therefore, that erodes that kind of a, even though it's a relativistic theory, it erodes these sort of absolute differences that cause people, put them into these life and death, you know, killing or kill or be killed situations. And also, of course, made them more tending to be more gentle to the animal kingdom because, in fact, the animal kingdom, everyone has been personally an animal. Many, many lifetimes we all have been. And as an we've been predators and predated as well. And as predators, we became less predatory and therefore evolved toward being a mammal, and then evolved, which is at least a female mammal has the experience of having their own young inside their body. So their sense of absoluteness, like a reptile, just drops eggs outside. They have eggs only inside, but the actual beings are, they don't have the same sense of connection to like the mammal female. And then the human one in particular is not actually an effective body as a predator, although we reinvented how to be a worse predator, of course. But we don't naturally have claws and fangs, and you know, we're not that quick on our feet like a cheetah to catch an antelope, you know. So that was the force for good released by Shakyamuni. Then, of course, it became incorporated everywhere here and there as a religion. But since the underlying drive was service of human beings to gain better control of their lives, of their minds, of their speech, of their societies, and to be happier and to be free from suffering. That's actually what it is, a service, which therefore Buddhism was able to get along with Hinduism, with Confucianism, with Taoism, etc. Now and then, when seen as a religion, there was some competition here and there, especially in the courts of kings over the centuries. But basically, it's just like Dalai Lama today wants to have a secular ethic, and he considers secular humanists, materialists even, and he's always was on my case about that, he considers them to be a world religion, a world ideology, if you will, a world worldview. And he considers them a billion strong, actually. I don't know who counted that, but he considers what he calls non-believers to be a billion strong. And he kind of upsets sometimes, like Archbishop of this or that, by saying in our interreligious thing, we should have some secular humanists. You know, they should be there because in a way they are a world religion, you know. And he's not favoring, maybe he a little bit favors them. Maybe that's one of my debates I have with him. Maybe he over favors the scientists. I don't know. He feels sorry for them. Although once, and only once did he satisfy me in teasing them. I'm not going to tell that story just now, but I might tell it later. Okay. So therefore, I see Buddha as a scientist coming up with, and therefore that makes this era of ours really positive, because we have had the Copenhagen Declaration, and although our scientists are loath to face that fact, their minds have come back into being part of nature automatically by matter disappearing, and they have the theoretical humility by some of their leading physicists to say that we were not going to capture reality in our theories, in our mathematics, and we're not going to be the high priests of a new permanent
religion, which the materialist sort of reductionizing everything and controlling it all, We're not going to do that. Which the British, someone like Bertrand Russell, Principia Mathematica, he thought he was following on Newton, and he was going to come up with a perfect theoretical notation to fit with the absolute simple elements of reality, material reality, perfectly adapted and fitting to them, so that then finally philosophy / science would have control, theoretical control of the nature of reality. And Wittgenstein sort of did him one better at first and then dumped the whole enterprise. Which I love that, actually. So then now we come to today. So now we come to the sources of the force for good. And we can do so without upsetting Dan Goldman, because actually the sutra that we're going to look at now is a secular document, actually. But maybe by the time it was written as a document, it's no longer secular. I have to acknowledge that. By the time the Sri Lankans wrote it down, about 7-8 centuries after the Buddha taught. And then we think, well, then it couldn't resemble what he actually said in any way. It must have been changed totally over so long. But that's partly because we don't understand the memory, the mnemonic ability of the Indian society civilization in those days. I have a former graduate student of mine, a graduate of mine, PhD graduate of mine, who had trouble getting a job as a Hindu or Buddhist studies or Sanskritist, because there's not many such jobs in academia, in Western academia. So he went back and got another PhD in neuroscience in Italy, and had a nice diet while he was getting it, and then went and studied Vedic chanters and priests today in India. And they have a brain, their memory area in the brain is like the London taxi driver. It's unique. It has a gigantic storage that accurately stores these Vedic hymns that they recite and chant in the rituals. Thousands of pages of them, amazingly. And although actually the only thing close to it that they have on neuroscientific record are London taxi drivers, the old London taxi drivers. I don't know if the new ones have to pass the test of every little alley and weird thing in London, but the old ones were able to do that. So now, the Samana, so therefore, although this was written in the Pali language in Sri Lanka, many, many centuries after the Buddha's time, and the monks had a system, the mendicants had a system in the many, many thousands of Buddhist monasteries all over India and Sri Lanka by that time, where a certain number of monks knew a certain number of these suttas, these teachings verbally given by Buddha, because he didn't write anything down. He made one drawing, but he didn't write anything down once he was enlightened. But they, when they would get old, they would have several disciples who would then, he would transmit the memorization to, who would memorize. And the fact that they kept them very pristinely that way is very, very possible, actually. So, modern scholars like to have this thing of, well, the real Buddha, nobody knows, maybe he never existed. And actually, the Buddhists themselves were asking that question only 300 or 400 years. There's a book called The Questions of King Milinda in English, where the monk Nagasena, the Greco-Bactrian king of a certain principality in Pakistan, who's talking to a Buddhist monk in the 3rd century before the Common Era, or 2nd or 3rd century before the Common Era, asked Nagasena, since he never met the Buddha personally, could he allow for the possibility that maybe Buddha never existed? And Nagasena saying, yeah, that's possible. Maybe it's just a group delusion that I've inherited. But then he had a counter argument, because the teaching is so amazing, it must have come from a certain source. So the Buddhists were already thinking about maybe there was never such a thing as the Buddha themselves, and rejecting that idea. Because when you read this, you kind of enter Buddha's mind, actually. And that's what we're going to do. Okay? Now, Samanapala Sutta means, he translated fruits of the homeless life. This particular translator, which is a good, reasonable translation. Sutta could mean, a discourse. In Buddhism, it means a discourse by the Buddha. you know, where it's more or less, although it has some description of how where it happened, connected it to it, so it's not only his speech, you know, is it about where it happened and who he talked to and so on. But the main point of it is what he said. And pala means fruit or effect, cause and effect. But samana does have a homeless life. A shamana means someone who, a seeker is what it means. The life of a seeker. But in that day in India, the Indian economy and society was so wealthy and so generous that all you had to do was sort of convince people that you were a seeker of truth and you had a lifelong scholarship from the whole society. You didn't have to have a paper, you didn't have to apply, you just stopped working, stopped service in the army, maybe you had to have permission from your family in some late after a while, and you were supported for lifelong study and meditation by the whole society with an infinite free lunch. Exactly what we don't have in America. There would be a free lunch provided to you by the kings, by the priests. The priests were a little upset about it, but Buddha was very careful with those mendicants who created this community not to do anything that the priests did, not to do anything religious. In other words, the Buddhist mendicants were prohibited from performing naming ceremonies, marriage ceremonies, divination ceremonies, funerals. They were prohibited from doing any of those things, which was the livelihood of the Brahmins, the priests, which is why Buddha was not crucified, you know, or like strung up or something, because he was leaving them with their livelihood, those priests. Later on, when it became highly established, then Buddhist monks did begin to serve like as priests here and there. But for centuries, they did not. And still, a monk technically is forbidden from doing that. And so when they have their bi-monthly meetings, twice a month meetings, if that's what bi-monthly means, twice a month meetings to cleanse themselves of their infractions, the monks, I performed a wedding. I'm sorry, you know. I let that couple get into the misery of samsara even deeper by having a marriage relationship. And they apologize to the other monks, and then they're given like so many Hail Marys, you know, so many Om Mani Padme Hums to recite. So now that's what a shamana is. So now this sutta is very important one, they consider it, because it's requoted in many other sutras, so it's a good one. Now first, that's what I heard once. It's a mistranslation to say once the Lord. It should say, thus have I heard, or really, thus did I hear once, or at one time, it should say. Why? Evam maya shrutam ekasmin samaye, and the Pali equivalent of that. What that means is, that's the signature of authenticity. Because one of Buddha's cousins, I think, Ananda was his name, became a greatly enlightened arhat, but not during Buddha's lifetime. He so faithfully served the Buddha as his kind of attendant once he became a mendicant that he sort of never had time to really realize the Buddha's teaching. But he was an idiot savant. He had a savant quality. He could remember everything that you said. For 2 hours, he would repeat to you. And he had all of Buddha's statements by heart, supposedly. So when Buddha died, he was the next successor who Buddha designated as the leader of the mendicant community by that time, which was quite large, Mahakasyapa, or Mahakasapa in Pali, kicked Ananda out. And he said, you have to leave the community because you didn't ask Buddha to live forever. One time Buddha said, you know, Buddha can live as long as he likes, and you didn't ask him. So then he died at 80, and we're upset about it. And I don't even want to, I'm almost the same age as Buddha, I don't want to lead this community, so, and you let us down, so you're out. So then Ananda was no longer a mendicant, and he was like, well, bereft, and Buddha had died. So he immediately went into Samadhi under a tree somewhere and retained the arhatship. So then naturally they let him back. They were only like putting him out so that he wasn't depending on anybody, and he would have to think it through, you know, and he would have to contemplate it and have to realize And then he became a great leader of the community, actually, himself. Much longer, because he was younger. Much longer than Mahakasapa. He became the second great leader, Ananda. So it should be, thus did I hear at one time. On a certain occasion, period. Meaning, Ananda is the one reciting this. Therefore, the Buddha really did say this. That's what it means. The Westerners translate it like that because they don't believe in the whole thing. They don't think there's any such thing as enlightenment. And they're doing once upon a time. It's a fairy tale for them. So it's very rude, actually. This does have heard. Then once. I even had... Never mind, I won't go into that. Okay. Thus have I heard at one time. Thus did I hear at a certain occasion. And what was the certain occasion? Well, the Lord was staying at Rajagriha, the capital of the Magadha kingdom, in Jivaka Kumara Bacha's mango grove. Jivaka was a famous doctor in Buddha's time. And there's a history about the characters in here, which I will tell you. And so he was staying there. In other words, the other thing that the early mendicants didn't have is they didn't have fixed abodes, fixed habitations. But they had different groves they were given. And then when the rains came, they would make little huts for them or some shelters and things. And these gradually became what we might think of as monasteries. But initially, they were so much seekers, and they only ate before noon, so they would not sleep heavily, and they would meditate a lot, and study and think and try to figure out the nature of reality, which is what they were doing. And they were together with a large company of some 1,250 mendicants, it should say. Although we call them monks, you know, but it's different than a religious Christian monk. It's a mendicant, the seeker of reality, a shramana. Which shramana also means to wander somewhere, a wandering seeker. And at that time, King Ajatashatru, Vedehiputta of Magadha, as he was the king, having gone up to the roof of his palace, was sitting there surrounded by his ministers on the 15th fast day, at the full moon of the fourth month, called Komudi. Oh, really? I never noticed that. That actually is the day of Buddha's enlightenment, usually. The lunar month, it means. Fourth lunar month. And that is always celebrated as Buddha's birth in the Indian and Tibetan tradition, at least, the Mahayana tradition. Birth, enlightenment, and death, parinirvana, a withdrawal from his ordinary body. So it was a very auspicious day. Now, that king, Ajatashatru, was a patricide and a matricide and a regicide. He was an arch criminal. He killed his father and mother, and of course the father was the king, and so he killed his king because he was misled by Buddha's half-brother called Devadatta, who was like the Judas of the Buddha story. A very bad guy. And by this time, this is later in Buddha's life that Ajatashatru is the king again, you know. And later in his life, and so this guy himself tried to kill the Buddha in company as well. He tried to kill the Buddha as well, unleashing a crazed elephant where the Buddha was walking to as a mendicant in his city. And he conspired with Buddha's half-brother to release an elephant to trample him. But when the elephant came up to Buddha, the elephant thought he met his mother or something, and so he just calmed down. Buddha patted him, nice elephant. So they didn't get to kill him, but he tried. So this Ajatashatru was a really ugly customer, in short. And it's a long story about the thing, but he was misled by Buddha's half-brother. Although, just to introduce a different note, that half-brother in the Mahayana is said to have been Buddha's first person in a previous life who taught him the Lotus Sutra. And it's actually a Bodhisattva who's being the bad guy in the Buddha story to show the Buddha how he reacts to a super bad guy. But that's the Mahayana, and that we'll get to later. But I can't resist putting that in. Anyway, it's the bad guy. So he's thinking, well, what shall we do, delightful friends? And King Ajatashatru, on that fast day, gave vent to this solemn utterance. Delightful friends is this moonlight night. Charming is this moonlight night. Auspicious is this moonlight night. can we not today visit some ascetic, that's a shramana, he's translating, seeker it should be, or priest, seeker or priest. You know, Brahman means a priest, you know, like one who does rituals. Seeker is one who meditates and seeks the nature of reality. Some seeker or some mendicant or Brahman to visit whom would bring peace to our heart. Now, his heart is not peaceful because he killed his father, mother, and tried to kill the Buddha. But he's forgotten about that, sort of. But he doesn't ask to see Buddha. He just some ascetic or Brahman. You know? By this time, Buddha is very famous, but he doesn't say, let's go see Buddha. Then one minister said to King Ajatasattu, and then I'm going to skip here because I want to get to other parts. So then they list six people that they suggest that he, different ministers suggest that he goes to, six teachers. One of them actually supposedly is Mahavira, founder of Jainism. So he a little bit, in the Pali literature, he has a little bit, has a certain negative, slightly negative role. Anyway, there are six of them, and King Ajatasattu doesn't respond to their suggestions, and we'll find out later why in the sutta. But by not responding, he's not agreeing to follow their suggestion. So he just was silent, means he doesn't want to go there and see that one. Okay. So then another. So then finally, at this all this time. Jivaka, that's the doctor, the royal doctor, and a great surgeon, actually, supposedly, did brain surgery on some, in some stories, was sitting silently near King Ajatasattu. And the king said to him, "You friend Jivaka, why are you silent?" So then Jivaka answers, "Sire, there is this blessed Lord, Bhagavan," that's one name of Buddha, "the Arhat, the fully enlightened Buddha, staying in my mango grove with a large company of some 1,250 monks. And concerning the blessed Gotama," he refers to Buddha as the Shakyamuni as Gotama, this is his family, that's his clan name, "this fair report has been spread about. This Bhagavan," so Bhagavan means sort of happy, lucky person, you know, Bhaga has a lot of meanings, but it means sort of a share, fortune, and just, I can't resist saying it, also happens to mean the vagina as well. So, but Bhagavan is the word they use for God, later Hinduism, and the first use of it that we know of is for Buddha in Buddhism, Bhagavan. So, this blessed Lord, this Bhagavan is an arhat, a fully enlightened Buddha. Arhat means one who has conquered the enemy of ignorance, so an enlightened person. Endowed with wisdom and conduct, wisdom and ethics, better, the welfarer, the happy one, actually. He's not on welfare. He is on welfare, actually, because I told you the whole country gives free lunch to anybody who sincerely is seeking, not to everybody, but just anybody, but to sincerely seeking the nature of reality, you know, a sincere seeker. So he is on welfare anyway, but this sugata doesn't mean welfare. It means sukham gata, means one who has gone to bliss. So blissful one is what it means properly. Knower of the worlds, knower of the relative world, that is, incomparable teacher of humans to be tamed, tameable humans. And tame is the word they use for educate, actually. I don't like training all the time. Educator of humans, of educable humans. Teacher of gods and humans, another name. Deva Manushyanam Shasta, the teacher of humans and gods, both. Enlightened and blessed. May your majesty visit the blessed Lord. He may well bring peace to your majesty's heart. And the Jatashatru then works up his courage, because he probably can remember that he tried to kill this particular seeker. But by now, his Buddha has become also very famous and has a large following. So he now agrees, he works up his courage. So he says, "Then Jivaka, have the riding elephants made ready." He goes on his elephant. "Very good, sire," said Jivaka, and he had 500 she-elephants made ready, and for the king, the royal tusker. Then that's the kind of way they behaved, those Indian kings, supposedly. And so they went, and he brought his 500 wives with him. He really was self-indulgent. And they went there. But now this is very interesting, of course. But when King Ajatasattu came near the mango grove, he felt fear and terror and the rising of the hairs. know, on the back of his neck. And the king said to Jivaka, "Friend Jivaka, you're not deceiving me, I hope. You're not tricking me. You're not delivering me up to an enemy. How is it that from this great number of 1,250 mendicants, not a sneeze, a cough, or a shout is to be heard? It's so silent there, you know." But also, unconsciously, he knows he's approaching someone who he tried to kill. And even at an even deeper level, he's entered kind of a closer field of the Buddha. So he's becoming more self-aware. And he's finding deep fear that he carries within him from this really evil thing he did of killing his mother and father, which really stays and haunts somebody, you know, definitely, even though they can live in denial or whatever. And actually, Jivaka did help him in one way. He was going to actually slay the mother with his sword. He was so furious. He had put his father to starve to death in a prison, but the mother visited the father regularly, was allowed visitation, and then used to smear her body with, you know, organic, gluten-free sesame paste and whatever, and he wasn't dying. So then he caught the mother, like, rubbed down with food and honey and stuff. And then he got so angry he was going to kill her physically with a sword. And Jivaka said, no, don't physically do it, that's even worse. At least just enclose her with the father. Because the good doctor couldn't get him to not do it. You know? So now he's feeling terrified, right? "Have no fear, Your Majesty, I would not deceive you or trick you or deliver you up to an enemy. Approach, sire, approach. There are the lights burning in the round pavilion," where at this point had been built there, which he, Jivaka, had built for Buddha, which was his teaching place. So King Ajatasattu, having ridden his elephant as far as the ground would permit, alighted and continued on foot to the door of the round pavilion. Then he said, "Jivaka, where is the Lord, the Bhagavan?" And then Jivaka points out a mendicant sitting there. And, "That is the Lord, sire. That is the Bhagavan sitting against the middle column." So he apparently was not seated on a higher seat, because he couldn't tell which one it was. Just against the middle column with his order of monks in front of him. Then King Ajatasattu went up to the Lord and stood to one side. And standing there to one side, the king observed how the order of monks considered in silence like a clear lake. And he exclaimed, talking to himself, "If only Prince Udayabandha, that's his son, were possessed of such calm as this order of monks. Do your thoughts go to the one you love, Your Majesty?" Oh, then Buddha speaks to him. He should say that. The Buddha then addresses him and says, "Do your thoughts go to the one you love, Your Majesty?" And then, "Lord, Prince Udayabada is very dear to me. If only he were possessed of the same calm as this order of monks." No kidding. They should put "the Buddha said." I never noticed that. Amazing. A little bit of a, you know, there are always errors and everything. It's unbelievable. So then, the first Buddha spoke to him. And get this, he's killed his own father. So naturally, he's really nervous about his son, subconsciously. But yet he loves him. So Buddha's first thing is to point out to him that you love your son, do you? And he involuntarily says, "Oh, I wish they were as calm and peaceful as all these mendicants." It's really deep. It's just interpersonal. It's not religion. It's not religion. It's secular. Then King Ajatasattu, having bowed down to the Lord and saluted the order of monks with joined hands, sat down to one and said, "Lord, I would ask something if the Lord would deign to answer me. Ask Your Majesty anything you like." And now he asks all these different, you know, professions. And he says, all of these people are delighted and pleased with this, you know, the different things they do and the skills they have. You can read yourself all the professions. They themselves, they enjoy here and now the visible fruits of their skills. They themselves are delighted and pleased with this, as are their parents, children, and colleagues and friends. They maintain and support ascetics and priests, like you, thus assuring for themselves a heavenly happy reward tending toward paradise. So he's accepting accepting the social thing, that to support seekers and, of course, priests, that's religious. And seekers are a little different category, but they're kind of making it religious at this point, and they get a good reward for supporting them. Can you, Lord Bhagavan, point to such a reward visible here and now as a fruit of the seeker's life? The Sramanapala. Now, Buddha, this is why I love this next thing, which I will compress to get through it, to get to the easier parts. He then, Buddha, with that, instead of answering right away, he says to him, "Your Majesty, do you admit that you have put this question to other seekers and priests, ascetics and Brahmins?" "And I admit it, Lord," then he says. And Buddha knows that he did. "And it's, would your Majesty mind saying how they replied?" the Buddha asks. "I do not mind telling the Lord or one like him or anybody else." He's sort of, anybody asks me that, I'll tell them. "Well then, Your Majesty, tell me." Then he goes through six people, which were the same six people earlier that the minister suggested he go see, and he was silent. Remember, he didn't go. Now it turns out he'd already gone to them on other full moons, asked them the question. And then he remembers, he's not stupid, he remembers what they told him, but he said, but each one of them just told him their theory of life rather than answer his question. So he said, "Thus, Lord," he ends this first one, but they all end the same way, "on being Purana Kasapa, on being asked about the present fruits of the homeless life, explain non-action to me," which is his doctrine, like, you know, Wu Wei, you know, don't do anything. You know, sort of like Indian form of Taoism, of way, one way of understanding Taoism. "Just as if on being asked about a mango, he would describe a breadfruit tree, or on being asked about a breadfruit tree, he would describe a mango. So Purana Kasapa, on being asked about the present fruits of the homeless life, explain non-action to me. And Lord, I thought, how should one like me think despitefully of any ascetic or Brahmin dwelling in my territory? I don't want to be disgusted with him," in other words, because he's a holy person, he's an ascetic. "So I neither applauded nor rejected Purana Kasapa's words, but though displeased, not expressing my displeasure, saying nothing, rejecting and scorning speech, I got up and left."